This is Commerce Shenanigans, episode 1024, a conversation with Mark Bagley. Welcome to the Commerce Shenanigans podcast. This is episode 1024. I am your host, Adam Chapman, and this is an episode I'm very excited about presenting. This is my interview with Mark Bagley. He's long been one of my favorite artists, especially Spider-Man artists. I definitely think of his take on the character when I think of Spider-Man in a big way. When I first started reading comics, I remember the first few Amazing Spider-Mans I ever saw were part of the Maximum Carnage crossover, which is part of why that crossover kind of always kind of looms large for me. One of the first, I think about a year or so later, I'd have to check the exact dating, but I remember, I think it must have been my 11th birthday, I got an issue of Amazing Spider-Man. It was issue 396, which I actually mentioned in this interview, and that was given to me. And I just loved that issue. I actually even sought out the second part of the storyline. It was Back from the Edge part 3 of 4, and I needed part 4. I needed to understand what was going to happen next, which was not by Mark Bagley. It was by Sal Buscema. So very different style, especially I believe that was during the Buscema inks. Sorry, the inking period by Sienkiewicz, but I could be wrong because it might have been a little too early for that. But it was definitely not Mark Bagley. They're just completely different styles. Great storytellers, but just very different styles. Anyway, so that was my love of Bagley's Spider-Man really started there. I remember a year or two later, I think I picked up at the newsstand Amazing Spider-Man 407. I also mentioned this in this interview. So this was a big one for me. I mentioned at the very end that, you know, for a long time, Mark Bagley was my white whale. He was the interview I always wanted to have and couldn't imagine getting. And it just felt difficult because I didn't even know how you get in touch with Mark. You know, he's not one of these artists who's all over social media and really easy to flag down. So I do have to thank Glenn Greenberg for helping to make this happen. It's been a couple years in the making, and this was an enormous pleasure. It was a lot of fun. I'm rambling a little, but it just meant a lot to me to be able to talk to Mark. And I think the magical thing about the comic book industry in general, you know, if you go to a con, you can see superstar creators and you can say thank you. You know, you can go up to them and say, I really love this, or this really meant a lot to me. And you can have this moment that you can't really have in the same meaningful way with anyone else, like in any other industry. Like, I'm not, you know, if there's a song I really like, what are the chances, especially if it's like a superstar, you know, if you want to tell Taylor Swift how much you like something, like, is that going to be possible? Probably not. Generally speaking, for most people, whereas you can go to a con, you know, you can have this engagement with these creators. And it's meaningful to you because you get to say that this thing meant a lot to you, either when you're growing up or, you know, you had a tough time and you read something or you saw this piece of artwork and it really meant something to you. But also, you know, especially for the artists, like they're at their drafting table all day. They're just working away and creating these pages, and they don't always necessarily get the fan reaction. So they go out to these conventions and they get to hear from people who really responded to their artwork. And so it's just as great a moment for them as it is for you as a participant, and someone who, you know, consumed their artwork, or their story if they're a writer. So anyways, that's a very long thing, but I'm very appreciative of the avenue that this podcast has given me to be at a point where I got to speak to Mark Bagley, and hopefully we'll do some more soon, which is even more exciting. So this was a really exciting one. I hope you enjoy this. I think it's about an hour and a half. I had a great time talking with Mark. He has some really interesting insights. We talk some of the hits, you know. You can't talk to someone like Mark who has entered into the industry in such a famous fashion and not talk about it a little bit. So we definitely talked about how he entered the comic industry, and what it was like kind of working on a variety of different books, having long runs, being a consistent artist. So I'll let him tell it. But thanks again for listening to this episode. You can email me at the Comic Shenanigans podcast. It's comicshenanigans@gmail.com. You can also like us on Apple Podcasts, listen to us on Apple Podcasts, and also listen to us on Spotify. Upcoming episodes, there's going to be an episode with Mike Carlin coming up. We got Glenn Greenberg coming back on the show to talk about his Star Trek Untold Voyages. So there's a lot of really exciting stuff coming up in the pipeline. We got, in a couple months, we got Pat Olive coming back with Chuck Austin to talk about Edge World Series, sorry, Season 2. So a lot of fun stuff. So I hope you stick around and download those episodes when they come out. So without further ado, you've waited 5 minutes. Let's jump right into the conversation with Mark Bagley. Enjoy. Mark, welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I am fine as wine.
It's very exciting to have you on the show. I told you last week when we first connected that you've always been one of my favorite artists, so the opportunity to talk to you on the show was a tremendous opportunity that I will not make light of, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, I am glad to do that, and let's see where this goes.
Okay.
Does this sound all right? I put you on speaker because it's easier to hold you to my ear.
This sounds good.
Okay, good.
So it's interesting. I was going to ask, I guess the biggest question is always, when did you first get into comics as a reader? Because after that, I'll ask the traditional question of how you broke into the industry. But I guess for you, that's kind of the most famous story there is of people breaking into the industry because of the Marvel Tryout book.
Yeah, that has pretty much been asked and answered about 500 times at this point.
So I'll ask instead about how you got into reading comics as a kid or how they became part of your life when you were younger.
Well, I'm one of seven children. My dad was in the military, traveled all over the place. I've got five brothers and a sister, and including a twin brother. And I'm the only one I ever read a comic book in my life. we were coming back from Japan and driving across the United States and California to Florida. It's just me, my dad, and I think three of my brothers. And mom flew with the rest of the kids.
Okay.
And we ran into this little place in the middle of the desert in Texas. I think it was Texas. And in the middle of the summer, no air conditioning in the car. Dad bought Dr. Peppers and comic books. And I kind of, at least this is how I feel in my mind. It may not be exactly accurate because kids' memories and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. I felt like that was the day that was like, wow, this is awesome. I mean, the first comic I remember ever reading was a Superboy comic. Couldn't tell you the number, but he was fighting a Kryptonian dragon. They actually made a model out of it back in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of hooked from then, and I was drawing, I remember I was in school drawing, just like doodling on during class when President Kennedy got shot.
Oh.
I mean, and there's nobody else in my family with any artistic, thing going on at all, and it's just me. So that's that.
When did you know that you actually had a talent for it? Because a lot of people try to draw, but there's special few who actually realize, oh, I can actually do this.
I don't know. I always felt like I could do it. I always, it's what I wanted to do. I joined the Army so I could afford to go to art school. And it just was something that, I'm good at two things. There's the art, and there's the other thing we won't talk about. Just ask my wife. but it was just always there for me, and I always wanted to do it. I mean, I got out of the Army and got out of art school and did construction for 3 years. And my wife swears I come home from, banging nails all day long in the middle of the summer in Georgia and draw every evening, I don't remember it quite like that, but I mean, I was the Marvel Trial Contest came along, and I was about 28 or 29 years old, and I was ready to quit trying to get in. I mean, I was like, I wasn't going to be a 30-year-old guy walking around a convention going, "Hey, look at my stuff," I had a job at Lockheed doing technical illustration, and a wife, and I had a kid, and I had a house, and If it wasn't going to happen, it wasn't going to happen. And, the trial contest came along and, that was it. It was, I didn't buy it. It was given to me by the guy at Comic Store, owns Comic Store, Cliff Biggers. He said, look, if you don't do this, you'll hate yourself. And, I won first place.
Wow.
And now we're talking about how I got into this. Everybody knows the story. But the point is, I don't know where it all comes from. I'm just blessed to have kind of this talent, and I've worked really, really hard to hone it. Because if you look at what I did when I broke in, I was just actually going through some stuff on my computer, some old scans and stuff, and they found that the trial contest artwork a number of years ago and sent it to me. It had been lost for like 10 years. Nobody'd seen it. It was in the Marvel cleaned out their old art room, and I look at it and go, oh, crap, I actually won a contest with that crap. and then I look at what I do now, and, I'm occasionally pretty pleased with it. So, it's just art. It's all a matter of growth. And it looks like it's worked out pretty well for me.
I remember being at a con years ago. This might have been 15, 16 years ago, and you were there. So it was in Canada. So I don't think you did many appearances in Canada. And I remember you talking at one point about how, and again, this relates to kind of your breaking in story, but, that you didn't think you'd ever be the best artist, but damn if anyone was ever going to work harder than you, and that you kind of had ascribed that to your work ethic because you got into the industry later than a lot of, other artists who got in at an earlier age and maybe had an easier time getting in, whereas yours, as you said, like, you had been doing other things, and then it finally happened, so you kind of retained this really hard work ethic, which definitely seems to have seeped through your entire career, that, you have more than anyone else, like, these long unbroken runs of working on different titles. Do you still feel that way, that, that no one's ever going to work as hard as you because of that work ethic?
Oh, no, I'm not working as hard as I used to work. I'm fucking old for that. But no, my philosophy was always, I'm never going to be the best artist out there. I'm not going to be the best storyteller, but I'm going to be a really pretty good artist and a really pretty good storyteller. And you know what? I'm going to get my work done on time and get it done. Be the guy who the editors can go, if I give this job to this guy, he's going to get it done. It's not going to be a problem. They used to say you had to be two out of three things. You had to be either really fast, really good. There were three things you had to be. There were these three things: really good, really fast, and really dependable. Okay, you had to be two out of those three. You could be really good and really fast, but if you weren't dependable, and you could be really good and really fast, and you'd get work, even if you weren't that dependable. You could be really dependable and really good, but not really fast, and you'd get work. You could be really fast and really dependable, but not very good, you'd still get work. So you had to be two out of those three, and I was always determined that, there's no way I was going to be the best. And there was no way it would, be the best, that sort of thing. But I knew I could be really good. I could be really dependable, and I could be pretty fast. And when I got in this business, you had to do three pages a day to make a living, three or four pages a day to make a living. You really did. I never got in this business thinking I was going to make any kind of money at all. I thought my wife would always work. I'd make a middle-class income, and if you factored in the hours I was working, I'd be making minimum wage. But I would love what I do for a living. And, in the 90s and, since then, it turned into actual, decent money. And, my philosophy was always, I'm going to stay employed because they know they can call me and it will get done. And that's how it is. And over the, I was looking at some old scans and that sort of thing, just going through. Yeah, it's funny. You look at stuff you did 5 years ago and you just flip through it, you're like, holy shit, I drew that. And then other times you look at it, you go, holy shit, I drew that. It's funny how the same sentence can mean two entirely different fucking things. But that's art, that's just the way it is. So, I rambled a lot there.
That's all right. When I was doing prep for this interview, I was kind of looking at the timelines of some of your work, because obviously I've followed your career for a long time. What I had forgotten was how many periods where you had some of your runs on books kind of overlapping with others, and so you were basically doing two books at a time for prolonged periods. Now, obviously, this was more in the 90s and early 2000s. What kind of fueled that drive to do that? Because that is, it's hard enough for a lot of artists to do a monthly book in and out and be dependable and be able to hit that deadline and not need a fill-in. But the fact that you did it with the frequency that you did while doing another book at the same time, or in the case of Ultimate Spider-Man, 18 books a year, how did you fuel that drive?
I got mortgages. No, but I can always do like a book and a half a month comfortably. I mean, quality work wise, I would be comfortable with the quality of the work, and it would get out there. I've slowed down quite a bit because I try to do better work now. And it's amazing. You look at what the guys did in the 60s, guys like John Romita and Gil Kane and Jeffrey Sim and those guys, the quality of the work they did for the speed they had to do it in was just insane. Because you go back and you really look at it and study it, it's just, you imagine John Romita or Gil Kane or John Buscema having 3 days to work on one page, like these guys do now. Can you imagine the kind of work they would have been able to put out? And, so when I was working back then, it was just a pace where, I was comfortable getting the quality of the work I could get out and love what even to this day, I could quit working tomorrow. And thank God, because of, how my career has been and a couple of things in my life, I could retire and not draw another line in my life. But I still work on a Sunday because, it's still a hobby. It's still, it's a hobby that they fucking pay me for, and they'll fly me places to sign autographs, and people will pay me for my autograph. Half the time I can't believe it, And my career has always been like that. It's like, back in the 90s and the 2000s when I was working 60, 70, sometimes 80 hours a week, I was still going. I'd get up in the morning and go, I'm drawing fucking Spider-Man and they're paying me to do it, And I know, like I said, I was in the Army, and then I did construction for 3 years, knowing I had a wife and a kid and bills and that sort of thing. And I fell off a couple roofs and, went to work in pain, working when it was 95 degrees or 98 degrees in the summertime. And, I'm sitting at a desk in my house listening to my music with air conditioning, and if it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm still at my desk and I want to crack a beer and, work while I have a beer. I'm not having anybody yelling at me over my shoulder, except for my wife occasionally. it doesn't get any, it may get better than that, but, it doesn't get much better than that. It really doesn't.
When you look back at the kind of the beginnings of the career and working on those New Universe books, it's fascinating how much of a proving ground that proved to be for a lot of people to kind of break in on a Marvel book, but it's not kind of part of the core continuity. Did it feel like, you'd made it yet? Or when was the moment when you kind of felt like you made it as a comic book artist? Was it taking over Spider-Man? Was it the launching the New Warriors and it becoming this phenomenon? What was that moment for you when you were first like, oh my God, it's happening? Or was it just the New Universe books?
When I broke in, I broke in, they flew me to New York, and for 3 days after the winning trial contest, and, every editor threw me out of their office. I was there with Doug Hazelwood, the inker, who won the contest with me, doing inking. And, like I said, every editor threw us out of their office, the deal was it flies up, and Jim Shooter was like literally out of the country because something had come up in Marvel UK and he had to go. So the last editor I saw on the last day gave me this one shot thing on the New Universe because the universe was going down in flames and it just needed somebody to work on it. And I did another one, I did another one, I did another one. And I was working at Lockheed doing technical illustration and doing Comics Ignite. And I lived for about a year and a half on about 4 hours of sleep a night.
Wow.
And right about the time that Lockheed, where I was working, started laying off, I was getting enough work from Marvel to actually think about doing it for a career. And at that point, I didn't know if it would go. You don't know how well it's going to go. But working from there, like I said, I was working 80 hours a week. My wife was working. About the time she decided she could afford to quit, not work, because I was making enough money, I decided to slow down my output for like a third because I wasn't getting the assignments I thought I should get because I was just working too fast. Mm. I wanted to do better work. Because it's always, when you're doing commercial art, when you're doing professional art, there's always this conflict of speed, quality, getting it done, and it's been from, Michelangelo when he was sponsored by the Medici's to, it's just a matter of, or designing toothpaste boxes. You got to get done at a point. And it's an art form, but it's also professional. Hmm. And there's always that conflict, and there's always that, there's that thing. And I think I knew I was going to be able to make a career out of it, when the New Warriors hit, and it was such a phenomenon. People seemed to really, really like it. And I was comfortable working and feeling like I'm getting better and better. Because if you look at my early New War, New Universe stuff and my Strike Force Moratori stuff, when you're young and you're working that hard, you improve really, really fucking fast. Now I work really hard. I try to improve. It takes longer because, maybe there's not that much more room to improve because of your talent, peak or whatever. Or just because you don't have that much to learn and you're just tweaking the edges, Back then, I was just the core of it. I was trying to learn as much and as I could and get better and better. And so, the quality of the work from the Visionaries to New Universe, New Warriors to my Spider-Man run, then it just got better and better, I think. And I just tried to do the best work I could. And like I said, I had jobs where, I put a skill saw in my thigh and got, 110, a whole bunch, I can't remember how many stitches, just ripped my thigh wide open with a skill saw. So I know what it's like to have a real job. And when I'm at my house doing what I'm doing, and, if you take that for granted, you're an idiot.
So I guess a question I have is when New Warriors hits, did you or Fabian have any idea that this was going to be what it was? Because again, it really took off fast.
No, I had no idea. I enjoyed it. Fabian was incredibly enthused about it. But, God bless Count the Falcon Ron friends, but their introduction was not really good. And, Night Thrasher, the Batman on a skateboard, and it was, to me, when I took it on, it was like, hey, I'm doing a real comic book. I'm doing actual Marvel characters in the Marvel universe. This is a really exciting opportunity. Fabian, he really fought to get me on the book because I was still kind of an up and comer, but he saw my potential, and he was in the office. He wasn't an editor. I forget exactly what his job at Marvel was, but he was in the Marvel offices, and he was able to push for me, and it really did. It took off really amazingly, and I thank God for it, because that's when I felt like, okay, I'm doing real comic books. People seem to be really enjoying it. I guess I'm doing something right. And I just need to keep doing something right and get better at it. Because to this day, I still feel like I'm, still trying to figure out how to do what I'm doing.
when you were working with Fabian on New Warriors, like what, I mean, obviously you're new to the industry at the time. Was he doing full scripts? Was he doing just, you know, kind of more Marvel style? Like when that, cause that's your first real ongoing, right? Like you'd obviously had stints in other books, for durations, but I guess this is the first, like you're launching it. You're the main guy.
Well, I had Visionaries was a toy tie-in comic, and that was an ongoing forever how long, what, seven right. issues. And I took over Strike Force Moratori and did that. And, and yeah, New Wars, it was the first mainstream Marvel comic that was an ongoing. And I was working at the time plot. It was just plot. It was, you know, Fabian would send me in a plot that was 8 or 9 pages long for a 22-page book. And I would break it down and lay it out and that sort of thing. And I worked with him on plot full time. And I'm pretty sure, I want to say the first time I worked full script was, I was an Alpha Flight fill-in issue I did with somebody. The guy who jumped off the Marriott Marquis lobby and killed himself. I can't remember his name right now. He wrote it.
Oh, geez.
I can't remember his name. It's awful. But, you know, Fabian and I pretty much always worked a lot until, I think, the Thunderbolts, when he took over the Thunderbolts from Kurt Busiek. And I worked script-wise. And I kind of miss working off of just the plot, but because it's more of a challenge and it's, you know, it lays more of the storytelling on me, but it is a little bit easier on the script. There's lots of writers really cool about how you tell the story, and the script isn't nearly as confining as you would think it would be.
When, again, going back to kind of New Warriors, it's only about a year or so in, I think it's around issue 15, when you take on doing Amazing Spider-Man at the same time, and you do this, you know, you're doing both of them at the same time for just over a year. What was that like? Because, I mean, New Warriors brings you, you know, in really into the zeitgeist. It's this big launch. It really does really well. But now you're getting to do Amazing Spider-Man, who, you know, and the big flagship book. What was it like kind of managing both? And then did you have to make a decision on which one you would stick with?
Absolutely, yeah. I stayed on New Warriors probably longer than I should have when I got Amazing Spider-Man, because that has always been my goal, to do a mainstream. I mean, and Spider-Man has always been my favorite character, book I always wanted to do. And
that works out since you're, you know, you are thought of as synonymous with Spider-Man, so.
Yeah, it has worked out really well. But, you know, I was doing New Warriors, and Danny Fingeroff was editing Spider-Man and New Warriors, and he kind of knew that I, you know, that's real, what I really wanted to do. So when they gave it to me, I was still doing New Warriors because I didn't want to leave it and leave it in lurch, that sort of thing. But I can't, I even at that time, I couldn't do really 2 books a month without really killing myself. So even my New Warriors, on the last 3 or 4 issues, I did just breakdowns for the ink. And then I had to step away from it when the time came for that. But, when I got to do Amazing Spider-Man, that's when, you know, okay, I'm V. Mark Bagley now, you know. That's kind of the family joke, is V. Mark Bagley, because every now and then, you know, every now and then I get to get in regular life where, wait a minute, you're V. Mark Bagley? The one who draws Spider-Man? You know, because you know, you're drawing comics and you're drawing, say, Moon Knight, or you're drawing Daredevil, or you're drawing, you know, hell, even the Justice League. You tell somebody that, they're like, oh, you do comics, drawing, you know, Daredevil. That's really interesting. That's kind of interesting. You tell them you're drawing Spider-Man, they're like, holy shit, you're drawing Spider-Man. You know, or there's like 4 characters that get that kind of reaction. You know, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, and, you know, maybe Iron Man at this point. And, you know, doing Spider-Man was that kind of a thing. And I just, coming off of Todd's run and Eric's run, and I just fell into it. And I guess I sort of have a gift for it, because like I say, it's always my favorite character, and it just seems, it appeals to me.
So a question, when you're doing Amazing Spider-Man with Dave Michelinie, so about a year in, I guess, is when you guys develop Carnage, would you have made the design a little bit easier if you thought it would have been as popular?
You've heard this line in other, if I'd have known I'd be drawing him 30 years later, I'd made him easier to draw. He's gotten more interesting to draw because I've started adding more details, and more, which makes him harder to draw if you got to spend more time on him, but I've added more noodling and detailing, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do all the just the veiny black stuff and everything. You have to kind of design it as you draw it, otherwise the character just looks flat and not well done. And I can name some guys who just couldn't draw Carnage or save their lives because it takes a certain amount of design to do it. So yeah, I would have made it easier to draw for sure.
During that first, I guess, I think it's 2 years into Amazing Spider-Man, again, because never one to rest on your laurels, you also launched the Venom Lethal Protector series, although you didn't finish that miniseries. Again, what was it like to kind of be juggling that much? Because that wasn't just a regular miniseries either. It was extra long issues.
I don't remember. Was it extra long? I didn't know it was that short.
Or, maybe I'm thinking of a different miniseries. I could be wrong there.
I wasn't a huge fan of the story arc, to be honest with you. It's kind of old subterranean San Francisco deal and that sort of thing. But, at the time, that was the 90s. That was during the peak of, the collector's boom back in the 90s and everything. And it was a crazy time because, like I said, I got into this business never thinking I'd make any money. And all of a sudden, I was getting royalty checks that would blow your mind. And a lot of guys were getting these checks and just disappearing. You get this huge check and you're like, okay, I'm done working for 6 months. Me, I was like, having the work ethic I had and the idea that this wasn't going to last, I was just working harder. And so I did Amazing Spider-Man and I did Lethal Protector. And like I said, I've never been a huge Venom fan or anything. I mean, people, I'm really identified with Venom because I've drawn so much of him. But as a character, it was never really a thing for me. But I did this series, and we were selling like a million copies an issue between Amazing Spider-Man and Venom. And it was, like I said, the times were crazy. The reason I didn't finish the series, this is actually a pretty interesting story, was I was doing Amazing Spider-Man and Venom, and it was going to be I think it's 4 issues, maybe it's 5, I don't remember exactly. And I got shingles. I was 2 or 3 issues in, and I came down with shingles on my, the disease shingles.
Mm-hmm.
You heard about it?
Absolutely.
Usually it hits around your waist, and it's incredibly painful. It's blisters and that sort of thing. It comes from chicken pox. And I got it on my face, which basically turned the left half of my face. I look like Toothpaste from Batman because it destroyed my face. And I called the office and said, I was in incredible pain and couldn't eat, couldn't work. And I was heading up on Amazing Spider-Man that, I could take a few issues off, but I couldn't do Venom as well. And they were like, well, you can still do the Venom and drop off Amazing Spider-Man. And at the time I thought, if I drop off Amazing Spider-Man, I'll never get back on that book.
Hmm.
I mean, GRG found that out. The second he left, it took him forever to get back on the book. And Amazing Spider-Man was the book I loved. I was doing Venom Lethal Protector because, it was a job, and it was a good job, and it was an incredibly well-paying job because that was the one, selling a million copies an issue. And I dropped off that book because I wanted to stay on Amazing. And I healed up and kept working. And the funny thing is, 6 months later, I don't know how much later, I was on some panel with this guy. He was doing some indie comic, and I can't remember who the hell it is. And we were all talking, in the panel, it's like 4 of us on the panel talking about, indie comics versus mainstream comics and yada, yada. And this guy's attitude is like, because you're doing mainstream comics, you're basically a sellout. You're basically not being a creator. You're just being a drone or whatever. And he turned to me, he looked at me, and he goes, have you ever done anything in comics just for the love of it? And I got pissed. Because I don't look at Spock. I don't care what you make. If you make a, you know, $10 million a year doing something, well, you probably earned it. You know, then I don't look at somebody else. And I got pissed. I looked at him. And in the crowd, I know there was a pretty good crowd. It must have been, you know, maybe 100 people in the audience. And I said, you know, I said, I was doing Amazing Spider-Man and Venom, and I got sick. I could have quit Amazing Spider-Man and done Venom, which was selling over a million copies an issue. And I stayed on Amazing because I love the book. And it probably cost me $200,000, which you'll never make in your entire fucking life. Oh, I was pissed. And, I make a living at this. And I've made a good living. And I'm so proud of it. But to this day, you know, if I was still working, you know, basically minimum wage and just grinding away, I'd still be doing it because I still love what I do for a living. Mm-hmm. God, I sound like a saint, don't I?
It's all good. So I do have to thank you because in 1994, so you did an issue of Amazing Spider-Man. It was, I believe, Amazing Spider-Man 396. It was a birthday present that someone, I think a relative, gave to me that issue. It was right at the beginning of the Clone Saga, but it was the first time I think I'd ever seen Daredevil in a comic. I didn't have a lot of comics at that time, but I had seen your art and really enjoyed it during Maximum Carnage. And then I get this issue, and you have Daredevil in the black armor costume. And to this day, I think a big reason why I love that costume is because of your rendition. So I do thank you for that. As much as I liked it so much that when I was getting married, my groomsman got me the Daredevil Black Armor statue for my groom's present. And I was very thankful. And again, I think I love that costume because of how great you made it look in that issue.
Well, thanks. That's really nice. I just drew that costume again for the first time in probably 15 years, 20 years for some Daredevil storyline going on right now. I just did a couple covers.
That's right. So they look great, by the way.
Thank you.
But I remember a couple years ago, there was some art dealer had a page from that issue. Unfortunately, it was a little bit above my price range because your 90s stuff was very expensive at times. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to add it to my collection. But I was like, oh, man, like, I remember this page, the Spider-Man and Daredevil hanging out at a dock. And I'm like, ah, I remember this when I was such a kid.
It's funny when you think back, if you're a comic book lover, because I love comic books growing up. Like I said, none of my brothers and my sister ever read comics. In 2001, when the first Avengers movie came out, I think it was 2010.
Yeah.
My twin brother, Mike, he bought his first house. I'd owned like four houses. Mike had never been married. And he invited us up to Ohio to stay at his house and see his house and see him. And so we went up and the Avengers was out. And Mike liked movies, but he never read a comic book in his life. So, yeah, I like to go see the Avengers. Mike talked like that. I hear I do a good Mike. So I said, okay. So, the movie, I'd already seen it like twice. And so we're coming home from the movie with my wife and I and Mike, and Mike's driving. And he says, so Mike, how'd you like the movie? I said, I liked it. So that's good. He says, we got a couple questions, though. I said, yeah. He says, so, at the end of the movie, the guy with the hammer, he goes home. And my wife and I both go, the guy with the fucking hammer? You mean Thor? Mike loved golf. I played golf, but I know who Tiger Woods is. How do you not know who Thor is? You know, that was my life growing up. That was my twin brother. So, I forget where this question came from, but that was my life growing. You think back to the comics you love. It's like, mm-hmm. I remember you. I remember now. You were talking about this comic that you loved as a kid. You know, I remember I got sick and I was home, and I'd been in grocery store with my mom like 3 days before, and they always had that a spinner wheel of comics in the grocery store, and I had noticed that there was the new Hulk out with. They're introducing Doc Samson with Herb Trimpe artwork, and I remember seeing it. I was sick like 2 days later, and mom was going back to the grocery store, and he's like, "Anything you want from the store?" And my parents were like, you know, they're like Depression era parents. They held on a dime like you wouldn't believe, and they were not thrilled with me being in love with comics because they just didn't get it. And would you buy me that old comic? And she went, oh, and she bought me that Hulk comic, which really, really meant a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. I remember comics from when I was a kid that just, you know, you remember this day, like, it really meant something to you.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I always think it's something to do with, you know, as a kid as well, you have this idea of scarcity. Like, you know, you get like a couple comics, and so you know that comic frontwards and backwards. As you get older and you're able to buy your own stuff, you know, you still enjoy that those things, but it's never going to have that same indelible mark because now you have choices and you have, you know, many things. But when you're younger, when you only have a couple things, those things mean everything.
Oh, yeah, and being my age now, sit down, kids. I'm 67. when I was a kid, we didn't have the whole, you know, comic book stores. You know, I had like 7 or 8 places I had to ride my bike to find the comics every week that I could find. And if you couldn't find it, you have to find somebody who had it and that you could buy it from or swap for it. Because you didn't have a place you could go every week to find everything that came out. And that was half the fun, you know. It was almost like, you know, a treasure hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that as being part of the thrill of it, I guess.
For sure. I remember trying to explain to my son the idea of, like, when you were a kid, you know, you'd hear a song on the radio and you wouldn't know what song that was. And the only way to, like, find out what song it was, you'd have to, like, wait till the next commercial break and hope that they mentioned what that song was. Sometimes you'd be unlucky and they would have introduced it at the beginning of the song before you started hearing it. And there was no way to, like, look it up. There was no internet to do that. You just had to, you know, listen to it on the radio and then maybe you'd be lucky to know it's coming on. You'd be able to, like, record it off the radio. But, like, there was very much lost in him because he's 10 years old and the internet is just always been around for him, but it's hard for him to understand that there was a time when that treasure hunt that you mentioned actually made it matter more, because nowadays, if I wonder what a song is, I can just look it up by the lyrics in 2 seconds and then probably it's gone. I probably won't ever think of that song again. But if I had to search and search and wonder what it was, it'll become part of that journey. And that's why I'll remember that song. So it's unfortunate in some ways that we're able to get answers and find these things out because that journey, that treasure isn't there anymore.
Oh, there's, you know, there's a total double-edged sword with, you know, the amount of information we have nowadays, you know, because there's so much out there now and it's so easy to get to that doesn't challenge you to have to find something and have it mean something to you because it's so hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not like a Cro-Magnon sometimes when I talk about it because I am like, but, you know, there is really something lost in that, you know. Mm-hmm.
I will say, a lot of times when I talk, people say that I sound your age. So don't worry.
How old are you?
I just turned 40.
I got underwear older than you are.
I don't doubt it.
It's an old joke. The second part of the joke is, and it looks better, but guess what? Anyway.
So a curious question. So when I actually was looking at it, I don't think I'd realized, obviously I know that you're very consistent, that I maybe hadn't realized that you had done, you know, for Amazing Spider-Man right from 351 right to your last issue of 416 with no, you know, no misses, no fill-ins. So what kind of led the decision to leave Amazing Spider-Man?
I was sick of it. To be honest with you, you know, we'd done the Clone Saga and you were... Amazing Spider-Man, there was, you know, the storylines were all connected with Web of Spider-Man and Dash Tiblet, Spectacular. So you didn't get to finish a story or start a story, or you were stuck in the middle of a story. And I wasn't crazy about the writer I was working with at the time. His name will remain nameless. And I was ready to go. And I was having trouble finding work in on anything. I was under contract with Marvel, but I was having trouble finding work from anything else because the editor in chief at the time, and it was Bob Harris. He denies it, but I've heard it from a couple of different people that he wasn't a fan of my work. So he was, I wasn't the new hot thing. So why give him any other thing to do? Hmm. And it took a while to get off it, but I was just ready to go. I was ready to put chances. And it's why I left Ultimate Spider. I wasn't sick of Ultimate Spider. I loved Ultimate Spider. I loved working with Brian. I loved storylines and everything else. But it was time to go. I'd done it long enough,
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing was sort of amazing, except I was, I was also like ready to go because I was really tired of it too.
Mm.
And I spent, after I got off an amazing, I had like an internet comic, which was before its time, and a couple other things, and Kurt Busiek, fought to get me on Thunderbolts. I mean, nobody wanted me on Thunderbolts, from what I heard in the editorial. They were like, no, it's going to be this new hot book, we want somebody hot, new, and that sort of thing. And Kurt wanted me because, I'm pretty darn good, and I'm really consistent, and, I'd get 12 issues done a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, which is becoming less and less important to these idiots. And, that was another, it was funny. It's, I've never been the really hot guy, the super A-list guy, but every book I've done has been successful, and every book I've taken over has done better than it did before me. So Thunderbolts is like, put him on this and see how it does. And shit, it went for like, I don't know how many issues, and they're still bumping it out, and they might be doing a movie of it. But granted, it doesn't have anything to do with my book, but the point is, it was successful enough that they could think about making a fucking movie out of it.
That's right. So I obviously will have to ask about Thunderbolts, but before I do, I want to at least point out another milestone issue that you only, not really a milestone issue, but an issue you did that meant a lot to me when I was younger, that again I want to kind of take a moment to at least put a spotlight on it, and that was Amazing Spider-Man 407, which would have been, I guess, the first Ben Reilly as Spider-Man issue of Amazing Spider-Man that you did, which had Spider-Man, Silver Sable was in it, and Sandman. I'm curious, I've always felt like you were probably one of the best at making that costume really sing, so I'm curious how you felt about the Ben Reilly Spider-Man costume.
This is the one with the big spider that goes...
That's right.
That goes across the shoulders and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I always like that. I mean, I get a lot of hate for that costume, but I always like that costume. I give Bob Budiansky, who was... I don't think he was the editor at the time. He must have been, because...
I think he was the group editor at this time, because okay, I think this was the time editor of the Five Chiefs.
Bob is... Yeah, I had done a bunch of sketches with the costume, and I couldn't quite figure out what to do with the chest area. And he actually sent back a sketch of, this is how you should finish up the chest area. So I give him credit for that. But, it was just a nice costume. I did tons and tons of costume designs. I mean, when they introduced the Ben Reilly costume with the hoodie that Tom Lyle ended up designing, Alex Saviak and Tom Lyle and I were all involved in, okay, we want to design a Spider-Man costume that's really not a costume, which I couldn't figure out how to do that. And, we came up with Tom Lyle and the hoodie thing. I like that costume that, I came up with the first Ben Reilly costume, which, it had, they did what? Mayday Parker? Is that her name?
Yeah, that's her.
And Spider-Girl.
Yeah, Ron Friend said that, and he liked the costume, but thought it would look a lot better on a woman.
Well, God bless Ron Friend.
he's a good friend of the show, so I always do.
Ron's a good guy.
For sure. That you'll have. I'll never disagree with that. He's a tremendously nice man. He's been extremely generous with me over the years, with this show and just on a personal level. So no, I'm glad he used that costume because again, it was such a favorite of mine. I remember having the action figure of the Ben Reilly Spider-Man costume. I've always been sad when it doesn't show up in video games because I just think it's a great design. So I do thank you for that. And specifically, you know, the Amazing Spider-Man 407 issue has always been just a real favorite of mine. I would always go back and reread it because your art looks so great in it.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
And is there something about you doing Silver Sable I really liked?
Well, she got boobs, so, you know.
Yes, she does. I'll go to Thunderbolts next. I mean, that it's interesting. Similar to New Warriors, like, did you have any inkling of how that would kind of play? Because that was, first of all, I think that's the last really big surprise that people can kind of point to in comics where there was a major reveal. It wasn't really spoiled. It was almost foiled a couple times, but it was actually something where you went on release day. It was there and it shocked and surprised people. And in a pre-internet era, or at least the internet was less prevalent, it was kind of the last time that ever really happened. So did you know going in that it would hit that way, or did you just hope it would?
I didn't know it was going to hit that way. I had no idea that it would be that taken that way. I mean, I took it on because, like I said, I was looking for other work besides Amazing Spider-Man, and I was a little burnt out. My head wasn't in the best place ever. In fact, the first issue, I sent in 3 or 4 pages, and Tom Brevoort was my direct editor, and he actually sent the pages back and said, look, you need to add some background in these pages, which is really embarrassing to me because I just hadn't, my head just wasn't in it. So I've had pages sent back because I've misinterpreted something or because, other things, like, but just because I just wasn't doing a good job, I'd never had anything sent back to me. And so I knuckled down and got it done. But the idea that reveal was going to be that big a deal, I had no idea. And it took off like nobody's business. Kurt was like writing at the top of his game for, you know, mainstream Marvel Comics, I think. And it was something because it was because the story was so good. I mean, yeah, the art was good, but so much of the time was about the artists. You know, the image guys were just, it's all the art. It's the art. You know, and the story is like secondary on everything. Well, you know what? It's really not. I always think the writers have the harder job. They gotta come up with this shit. I get to sit there with the script in front of me going, okay, I gotta visualize it, but I didn't have to come up with this. That's from out of nothing. And I think the Thunderbolts is like this fret. It's kind of like when I took over Amazing's, you know, Todd had just broken every rule and was drawing this insane looking Spider-Man. And yes, I wasn't a huge fan. Todd's, I think he's improved a lot. I think he's a hell of a good artist now. Then I wasn't a fan because of the style. Mm-hmm. And then Eric took over, and Eric's this so idiosyncratic. You know, so different. You know, incredibly talented, but you know, just not what cup of tea, but there's a better word. But the point is, I wanted to come in and just tell the stories. And you got the feeling these guys didn't want to tell the story. They just want to do the images, you know? And it's the same thing with Thunderbolts. There's so much out there of, it's just all about the visual. But there's something to be said for, you know, the subtle storyline. You know, I mean, one of the, you know, most interesting issues of Ultimate Spider-Man was issue 13, which I don't remember issue numbers, and usually, but issue 13 of Ultimate Spider-Man is where Peter reveals that he's Spider-Man to Mary Jane. The entire issue in his bedroom, and they're just sitting on the bed, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just storytelling. And I'd love to go back and redraw it because I could do it better now. But, you know, the point is, you can make a story really, really interesting without having splash pages and money shots and that sort of bullshit, but just having little subtle
like the nuances,
gestures towards things, you know. Mm-hmm. and I find that more interesting than anything else.
It's interesting reading, you know, when you were doing Thunderbolts, once Kurt brought Hawkeye under the book, there's something about your interpretation of Hawkeye that sticks out as one of my favorites. You and George Perez probably are kind of my top two favorite Hawkeye artists. And there's just something about how you portrayed him and the, there's that one issue where I think he was just like climbing a mountain or something, but there's just something about your visual storytelling with Clint that really kind of clicked for me. And always, when I think of my kind of favorite or ideal Hawkeye, it's usually the one that you drew.
Thanks. I remember that issue. I remember that bit, because I actually had to pull out of, you know, I had to go hunting for mountain climbing or, you know, rock climbing, you know, reference, because I wanted to make it look, you know, fairly realistic. And it was, that was before, you know, Google and before the internet. That's what that was back in the olden days when you actually had to look reference, you know. And I remember doing that and having a good time with it. Thunderbolts is fun because, like I said, there was just lots of storytelling you could do, and interesting characters. Hawkeye was such, you know, such a mainstream superhero character, and mm-hmm. throw him into that mix. It was a good gig. I mean, when I got to draw, you know, when Hercules showed up, and he's just pissed off because he realized that Atlas is actually Giant Man, who some of the guys almost killed him back in the Avengers. I mean, I really want to do just my best Jack Kirby, you know, Hercules, you know, from every little bit of it. It was fun to do, you know. Like I said, I'm enough of a geek, right? I love stuff like that.
A gag I really enjoyed, and I'm curious if it was more your idea or Kurt's idea. There's an issue of Thunderbolts where I think it was one of the crossovers with the Avengers, and Black Widow's talking to Hawkeye, and he's making a modification to his costume, and he comes out and the buckle's changed. But that's like his big change, that now he's the Thunderbolt, and it looks different. Was that kind of your gag, to just have it be a little Thunderbolt on his belt buckle, or was that something that came from Kurt?
I don't remember. I do know the design was... You know, my idea, it's not just the buckle, the whole costume is blacker and that sort of thing. But basically, yeah, the whole idea was the Thunderbolts, you know, M logo on his belt buckle. And I don't remember if Kurt asked for that or if I threw that in there. I'm pretty sure Kurt probably asked for it.
When you were working with Kurt, and actually this goes back a little bit as well to when you were working with Mika Laine as well, like as you progress through your career, you know, you start off with, you know, Fabian doing more plot. Was Mika Laine doing plot as well? Or, like, when did those people start doing more detailed plots? And when did you kind of see that as a sea change where you started seeing less and less plot first and more full script?
You know, I really don't remember if Kurt was doing... I'm pretty sure I was just doing plot on... I really don't want to say. I don't remember when it really shifted. I do remember, like, the only time I ever had any trouble with somebody when they were doing full script was when I was doing Strike Force Moratori. So, yeah, I guess it started around then. I mean, I guess full script started that early, but I was working with whatever the hell the guy's name is right now. I can't remember.
That's okay. There's no test.
Well, he gave me a hard time about this one panel sequence, which didn't make any fucking, you know, sense, and he wouldn't let me, he didn't want me to change it. I really don't remember, to be honest with you.
That's okay.
I think it was full plot up, I think Mika Laine was started doing scripts, but I think they got more and more full script, like, a little bit later after that. It's been a long freaking time.
I believe it. I'm curious, before you launched Thunderbolts, as you mentioned, you were kind of in that, you know, kind of post-Amazing Spider-Man, looking for the next kind of thing, kind of era. I'm curious how it came to be that you were working on Star Trek Mirror Mirror with Tom DeFalco.
It was just like, I need something to do, give me something. They just called in. Okay. And, you know, I love the mirror. I love that episode of Star Trek. I'm more of a Star Trek geek than I am a Star Wars geek. And the story was really, really good. But I do terrible likenesses. I really do. You know, a lot harder to go looking for images of people's faces and that sort of thing. And so it was really, just. That was one of those things. It was just a job to get me through, get to something else. Mm. So, that story was actually really pretty damn good. That was a really good sequel to that whole storyline, I think. And Tom did a good job on that. I did the best I could, but you go back, they did a lot of alterations on faces and things.
I'm curious, in that kind of first full decade of you working in the industry, what was your experience with seeing how inkers would interpret your work and how, certain inkers would add a little bit more of themselves to the work and some would be, more just accentuating what was on the page. How did you kind of feel about that and learning how that part of the business worked? Because it is interesting to see, you put on your pencils, but it is to a certain degree subject to whatever the inker may or may not end up doing with it. So how did you feel about that, especially in that first kind of decade as you're finding your way?
Oh, fucking anchors. Now, the first published work I ever had was New Universe, and it was an issue of Night Mask. And I was like, oh boy, this is like breaking the comics. I'm doing Night Mask. And Night Mask is this teenage kid who falls, you get into people's dreams. I don't even remember exactly what his deal was. But I mean, I worked my tail off on this book. His dream sequences, I got to throw in all this really cool stuff. I got this young kid and that sort of thing. And Ernie Chan inked it, and he just destroyed it. I mean, I thought I'd never work again. It just looked awful. I mean, made this kid look like a Cro-Magnon, and it was just, So, that was my first, was like, okay, yeah, bad inker's gonna just, a great inker makes you look better. Mm-hmm. A good inker look as good as you are, and a bad inker can fuck you up. And I'm at the stage now where, thankfully, I can kind of pick and choose who's inking me, and I don't have that issue. I mean, you don't have that luxury for a while until you get yourself fairly established. I mean, I got fairly lucky after that. I got Amazing Spider-Man. I had, Randy Amberlin did a really nice job. And then I'm drawing a blank on Anthony and New Warriors. Al Williamson did the first three issues. And he called me. And Al Williamson is like this legendary inker, this legendary artist. And I think the second issue in, or maybe the third issue in, he calls me and goes, I'm quitting this book. And I said, why? Because you're making me work too fucking hard. Because he was so much better than me. And he was fixing everything I was screwing up. And at that point, I'd kind of established myself enough to where, we had a couple of guys actually try out. And, who the hell was it?
Was it Malstad?
Yes. Yeah. Malstad. Larry Malstad. And he did just a great job. And he actually took over from Randy Emelin on Amazing Spider-Man on me. And so I, from that point on, I've been able to semi pick and choose. But like I said, a good inker will make you look better. And that's kind of his job. I mean, I'm one of these guys who, when I got into business, a penciler's job is to draw the issue, and an inker is supposed to come in and finish it. Supposed to make it. Because penciling and inking are different, and you can't pencil it to where it looks like a finished product. The inker has to finish it. And if you get too detailed with the pencils, then it's just makes it, then the inker just becomes a tracer, and that's not their job. And they don't have any fun doing that. I've got John Dell working on me now on my Spider-Man books, and John Dell and Drew Hennessy are my two go-to inkers right now. And you know, John, he told me, he was like, you know, he was like a boutique inker. He would work with these guys who, you know, would spend 3 days on a page penciling, but he would have to trace every line. And if he changed anything, they'd get pissed. Well, my idea is, you know, I lay it out and I draw it, you know, and I expect the inker to go in and take what I drew and accentuate it. And if they occasionally fuck something up, well, you know what? That occasionally happens. But when it's not happening, it's hopefully better. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been blessed, you know, for the last, I don't know, 20 years of my career to be able to not have to worry about a bad inker messing me up. I would love to ink my own stuff, but I'm just not fast enough at it, and I'm not, you know, I get bored. The fun I have is telling the story visually.
Hmm.
Having to finish it off and doing the inking and everything else, dude, it's just not what I want to do because I'm not that invested in the actual finished product. Hmm. Biggest fun I ever got with an editor. One of the things where the first time I ever told an editor I was not going to fucking redraw something was one of his lines was, well, you know, if you change this, the final art would be worth more money. I'm like, that's not my concern. My concern is telling the fucking story. And you know, every now and then, you know, John will screw something up or Drew will screw something up. And, you know, I'll either get him to change it or I just won't, you know, usually I'll let it go because, you know what, you start nitpicking what somebody does and they're second-guessing everything they do, it just messes them up.
Mm-hmm.
I've had try and do that to me where it's like they come at me with, well, you could have done this or you could do this. There's 14 different ways to do the same thing. And maybe you're not going to get the best way to do it every time. But you know what? You know, when you got a product to put out and a deadline to meet and other people who are, you know, dependent upon you getting it done in time so that they can do a good job, you know, you can't be second guessing yourself 1,000 different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't have an editor doing that to me, and I can't do that to an inker.
So I'm curious.
That was pretty intense, wasn't it?
It was very intense. I guess my question there is that you mentioned, like, you know, that you can't really ink yourself in kind of published work because you think it's too slow and you kind of disengage as well.
I've started inking my own covers in the last couple of years just because,
okay,
you know, I like you get to keep anything you ink, you get to keep, and covers the money. And you know, I'm at the point in my life where all my original artwork is basically, you know, a legacy for my kid and my grandkids, you know, so
mm-hmm.
as much, and plus I do like to ink. I've always liked to have my final vision of it there, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm still learning the techniques. I'm still, you know, trying to get better at it. I'm sure everything I've inked right up to this point, somebody could have inked better, but it wouldn't have been me inking it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to do the best I can at it.
When you do it, I mean, is it interesting to you to be able to kind of see it and say, like, this is the fully realized version of what I kind of saw in my head? Whereas, as you said, like, even with the best inker, they're making you look better, but it's not technically still your ink work, you know what I mean? So there's something, I guess, more pure about it when you do those covers on your own?
Yes, but there are also times when I look at, you know, there's a number of covers where, you know, John or Drew have inked that I just look at it and go, holy shit, that looks nice. Now, in fact, I told you, I was going through some old stuff just on my computer screens and looking at, it's funny, you look at old stuff and you go, oh, I drew that, and, oh, I drew that. And but you run across something, and it's like there's an amazing Spider-Man cover I did. It had to do with, I can't remember, Doc Ock and something. Anyway, there's a cover with Spider-Man, and he's being grabbed by this character. And John Dell inked it, and it's, you look at the inks, and it's like, okay, I drew that pretty good, but boy, that the ink's just making it look, and I couldn't have inked it like that. there's been a number of times that both those guys and Scott Hanna and a number of guys I worked with, I go, no, I'm trying to get really good, but these guys are on a different level, you know? And you got to be humble enough to understand, you know, and there are guys in this business I look at who draw, who got people who don't draw and just love comics, and they look at what I do and they just go, how did he do that? It's amazing. It's unbelievable. Mark Bagley is amazing. There are guys in this business I look at exactly the same way, where I go, holy shit, how do they do that? They're fucking amazing. And it keeps you really humble, and it keeps you thinking, you know, you might not be able to get that much that good, but you can darn well try, you know?
Mm-hmm. Actually, that brings up a question I didn't ask before, as we were kind of working through your Amazing Spider-Man work. You worked with Jan DeMatteis on what is usually kind of mentioned as damning with faint praise, and I apologize because I'm a big fan of the Clone Saga, but a lot of people say, oh, the best part of the Clone Saga was the death of Aunt May because that was a good issue, and you obviously were the illustrator of that issue. What was that like as a responsibility? Because you have the 400th issue, you know, it's going to be a big anniversary issue, but they're also killing off, you know, a legacy Silver Age character, and JMD delivers an amazing script. So how did you kind of interpret and take that on?
It was one of the best issues that I drew of Amazing Spider-Man, I think. It's funny, you know, you're drawing as an artist, sometimes you're on, sometimes you're off, you know, sometimes it's clicking, and other times it's just not. And that issue, it was clicking. It was a really, really good story. There are a few panels where John Romita came in and redrew some of my faces because he does a much better Peter Parker than I do. And that's...
Wait,
know,
really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's like probably four or five, maybe more than that. Yeah, maybe not that many, but there are some times when he came in. Because that's what John's job was to straighten shit out and things that be right. And Spider-Man, back then, was still the whole, you know, there's still the company line and how he's supposed to look. And I'm not the most consistent guy in the world sometimes. But I really, you know, that storyline, as much as I, you know, it was over the Clone Saga, I was on top of my game in that issue. And there's scenes in there where, you know, it's like the scene where, you know, he actually he's trying to tell her that he's Spider-Man, and she tells him that she's known. And they're on top of the Empire State Building.
Mm-hmm.
Got reference and the faces, and, you know, that's what I mean by it doesn't have to be huge splash pages every issue, every page. There's just places where they're just actors doing a scene, and it's just engaging the way they do it. And, you know, the death scene where, you know, there's this huge splash page where, you know, Mary Jane's standing there, and she's got her face in her hands, and Peter's on the bed holding Aunt May, and she's died. And then there's, you know, Ben, the clone, on the roof, and he's just crying because he can't be there. And I was really proud of that bit. I was really, because I think actually that bit was mine. I think that was my idea. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I could be wrong because it's been a while. So if DeMatt says no, then I'll totally go with that. But I was really proud of that whole bit, that scene where, you know, he's on the rooftop. He can't be there. You know, there's just tears falling out of him. And then she's a fucking actress, and John Byrne brought her back to life, and I just want to shoot him for that. But that's just me.
I don't think anyone is happy with how that was reversed, because, again, it was such a wonderful send-off. What I always appreciated about it was that, you know, she died of old age. It wasn't anything that Peter could blame himself for. It wasn't some superhero. It wasn't a hackneyed end. It was literally she was old and she passed away, and she'd been sick before. And I always thought that was very, you know, almost unheard of in comics to just let people die naturally, if that makes sense. And it made it more poignant. And one thing I did like that JMD did, and I know he did this when he killed off Harry Osborn with Sal Buscema, is that he leaves a lot of room for you to tell the story of the aftermath without any prose at all. I think there's 5 pages of just your storytelling of the funeral and just seeing people's emotions without him having to use a word. And that wouldn't happen if you weren't this, as strong a storyteller as you are.
Jim DeMatteis and I and Danny Fingeroth. Okay, so I was working on Amazing Spider-Man, and Jam has been working. He'd been working on Spectacular or Web of whichever one, and for a while. And Danny Fingeroth, one of his best friends in the world is DeMatteis, and Danny and I are really good friends. We get on really well, and so Danny thought that bringing us both together on the same book would be just great. The only trouble is I wasn't a huge fan of his work. It was, I always found it a little bit too psychological, it just didn't appeal to me. And so Danny brought us in and both of us in for a meeting about being on the same book together. And I was like, I don't really want to know if I want to work with this guy. It's just not what I want to do. And he was like, well, I don't really know if I want to work with you because, you know, you're this guy. And it was really uncomfortable. I mean, you could tell Danny was about to die. And we were like, okay, we'll give it a shot. Well, fuck it, whatever. You know, I think seriously the mood out of that meeting was like, fuck it, whatever, we'll do it, you know? It worked out that, you know, I enjoyed, you know, he and I actually enjoyed what we did together. I think I did some good work. I think you did some good work. I think the Clone Saga and all that bullshit in there got way out of control and constrained us to what we could do and the kind of work we could do. But, you know, for what it was, you know, I think we did some pretty good work together.
For sure. Near the end of your tenure, you introduced a new character, Delilah, who I originally talked to Richard Starkings about because she spoke in very specific speech patterns, which he was obviously a big part of kind of bringing to life in terms of the lettering. I'm curious if you have any remembrances of actually working on either Delilah or Stunner, who was about a year or two earlier.
Right. So Delilah was basically my vision of how Jim Lee would draw a character. I was thinking, okay, I'm gonna make her look exactly like a Jim Lee character. You know, like different pads on her snips. That was the only real memory I have of Delilah. I don't remember what her powers were or anything like that at all. Stunna, as I call her, I was dying to draw She-Hulk. I mean, I love drawing different body types and giving that sort of different, you know, physicalities and that sort of thing. And I don't think I came up with the idea of drawing like this kind of character or whatever, but when DeMatteis, I can't remember his first name, it's in my life right now.
JM or Mark?
Mark, right. Yeah, geez, I am tired and old. I just wanted to draw her thinking, okay, I'm drawing She-Hulk here. You know, that's basically what I'm doing. And, you know, I enjoy drawing it, you know, because, like I said, I enjoy drawing the physicalities of different characters. And I was really interested in She-Hulk at the time. I think John Byrne was doing She-Hulk at the time, and that book was doing really well. So that was sort of my version of it. You know, because doing this, you're drawing characters like you're drawing, you know, like these are actors in a movie. And we haven't talked anything about my DC work, but when I was doing JLA, I got to draw Power Girl and Supergirl together. And basically the same character. You know, Power Girl's from a different dimension, but she's supposed to be that dimension's version of Supergirl. But she's got this, you know, bodacious body, and Supergirl's this waif of a figure. And I enjoy drawing the dichotomy of that, you know? So that's neat.
When you're doing, I have been jumping around a bit, so I do apologize, but when you're doing The Amazing Spider-Man with Ben Reilly as Spider-Man, and you have the new design of Mysterio, was that your design, or was that Jurgen's design?
I'm not sure. sure what the, I think it was, it had to be Juergens, because I don't think I drew much Mysterio when I was doing the Clone Saga.
Yeah, there was only one storyline called Media Blizzard, and I think Amazing Spider-Man would have been, I guess, issue two of it. So I guess it does make sense that it would have started with Juergens. But do you remember that design in general and what it was like to draw it? Because it's very different than the classic fishbowl. And it was a lot of, like, wraps and mist. And I don't know if that was frustrating to draw or if you were just like, man, can't I just have the old fishbowl back?
Like I said, I don't remember actually drawing that. I vaguely remember what you're talking about. And, you know, it doesn't leave me with any kind of like emotional feeling at all.
So we talked before about Carnage, but what was it like when you had Spider Carnage? Because that's a design that definitely persists and it's stuck around in video games as alternate skins, and people really like that design and that overall look. Was that easier or more difficult to draw than Carnage? Because now you have a lot of the same Carnage accents, but you're now doing it over a Spider-Man costume.
It was just a thing that I had to do. I mean, that's all I felt about it. It's not really that. It's easier to draw than Carnage because it's not all the twirly tendrils going through them. There's just a few added on to basically the Ben Reilly costume and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. At that point, my Amazing Spider-Man career, I was really kind of burnt out and ready to move on to something else.
So I know you've talked about this in many other interviews about, as you said, you were kind of burnt out on Spider-Man, and then you become well-known for Ultimate Spider-Man and having the longest running kind of unbroken streak of issues with another creator. When that started, I know that you kind of went into it thinking, this will be short. And at what point did you realize it wasn't going to be short anymore?
You know, it was pitched to me as a 6-issue miniseries, and I turned it down 3 times. And, you know, when I realized I wanted to stay on, it was like the first issue came out, and the inks were great, and the coloring was great, and the paper was, it's the first time I'd had a book published in, you know, with fine paper, like not regular old comic stock paper. And it sold like crazy. The fans loved it. I mean, I had no idea it would go over that well. You know, I tell a story that, you know, John Byrne had just done his Spider-Man Year One or whatever, and it had gone over really badly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wasn't emotionally invested in the book at all. And I just told Marvel I was going to leave after the first 6 issues. And they actually offered it to somebody else and then took it back. But, you know, I when the first issue came out, basically, the same guy who gave me the Marvel trial book to draw when I wasn't going to buy it told me, look, you need to stay on this book because it's, you know, really, really hot. And at that point, I was getting what Brian was doing and enjoying what he was doing. The first 3 or 4 issues, I really wasn't getting it. I was really like, okay, just doing this as a job and getting it done and not understanding. I mean, the first issue is not in costume. What the fuck, you know? I just didn't get it. But then I started to, and like I said, you know, the fans really loved it, and I really loved it. I mean, I the storytelling, Brian's dialogue is so great, and he's so free about, yeah, his scripts are crazy. I mean, they're very detailed and they're very full, but you know what? He's very good about, you know, no, that's not going to work. We're going to do this, you know, unless he's really got an idea of what he really wants and there's a reason for it. He'd be like, okay, you know, I mean, to this day, I remember there was a scene where Peter is in a limo, in the back of a limo with a woman being driven towards, Norman Osborn's, skyscraper, and he's terrified because he knows Norman, knows who he is, and it's so terrible. And he has this panel with Brian Rice that he's looking through the front of the limousine, up through the Queensboro Bridge, to this building behind it, which is impossible to fucking draw. And I'm like, that's not going to happen. And so, you know, I forget exactly how I worked it out, figured it out, but, you know, Brian was totally cool with it. You know, it was just such a pleasure drawing his scripts because the dialogue is so sweet afterwards. And, you know, Peter was such a great kid to draw, and his whole cast of characters. And, you know, I'd go two or three issues without him in costume, which probably cost me thousands of dollars in original art sales. Because, you know, the readers were enjoying it, and I was loving it. And, you know, actually, the only reason I left was because I just felt like I needed to do something else. And Marvel at the time was always treating me really, really great. You know, the squeaky wheel always gets greased. I felt like I needed to give them a kick. Mm-hmm. And I've been talking to Kurt Busiek about going to DC, doing something with him. And it worked out that way.
I'm curious, as that run on Ultimate Spider-Man continued, and as, you know, it got closer and closer to, you know, kind of equaling Jack Kirby and Stan Lee on Fantastic Four, did that become part of the impetus to, like, keep it going since we're this close? Like, it sounds crass to say, but, I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, having a goal in mind. Like, did that become part of the kind of mental arithmetic about how long I'll stay on this?
Well, I tell the story, like, so I'm working on a book, and I'm having a great time, and the fans are loving it, and, you know, it's just awesome, and it's great, and we get up to about issue 70 or so, and we start hearing noises about, hey, you know, Kirby's record and Stan's record is 100 and something issues, and wouldn't that be great? And I'm thinking, well, this is stupid, who cares, you know, whatever. And Brian's the same way, he's like, oh, who cares, whatever. And then we get to about issue 90 or so, and, you know, and people are like, you know, they could break the record. It could be this. It could be that. It'd be awesome. And we're like, you know, that would be pretty cool, you know? But that would be cool. And then we get to about issue, you know, like 95 or 98. And I'm in my late 40s, early 50s. So I'm thinking, I could get sick. I could get hurt. This could be bad because this would be really cool to do. And, you know, and so, yeah, it got to be where it got to be a thing where we were really, really, really proud of it. You know, I always give out the disclaimer that, you know, yeah, okay, Stanley and Jack Kirby, they were doing, and Stan was plotting 10 different books, and Jack was, like, drawing 3 books and doing all the covers, right? Mm-hmm. We were doing our book. And granted, we were doing a year, but we were doing our book. So, I give that with that grain of salt. You ain't got, you know, but it is something that, you know, I look at my bookshelf and the hardcovers are there, and they're, you know, a foot and a half across with hardcovers. That's a really nice body of work. I've got fans who are, you know, 14 years old who have read it and love it and tell me that that's what got it into comics and what it means to them. And I've got fans who are 40, you know, who read it when they're in their 20s. Because it's hard to believe, but, you know, it's been 20 years since that book came out.
Oh, yeah.
The first, you know. But I've got fans in their 40s who read it and said that got them back into comics and how much they love it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can do miniseries after miniseries after miniseries, and they're great. And every 50th of them or 20th of them is The Dark Knight or The Watchmen or, you know, I'm trying to think of a third one.
I mean, for you, I'd say Spider-Man Life Story.
I don't know if that's that big a deal. That did a lot better than I ever thought it would. But the point I was trying to make is, you know, I've got this big body of work on that one book that really makes a statement. Mm-hmm. And it's a rare thing that does that. If you want to talk about Life Story, I had no idea it would do that well. How much people really seem to have loved it. And I'm, you know, the inking was great. The coloring was beautiful. You know, it really was a nice piece of work. I'm very proud of it.
I mean, I hope you get royalties in that, because I think I own that five different ways, so...
Well, I get a few royalties, so, you know, I'm always very happy with that.
So I've already kept you for so much of your time tonight, and it's funny, I think we're only up to, like, 2001 or so, so I feel like if you're ever willing to come back, I'd love to kind of chart the rest of your career, because you've been so gracious already. I do have a few listener questions that were submitted, if you wouldn't mind, for a quick lightning round.
That'd be fine.
Okay. So this first question comes from Tashman, who said the question that they most wanted to ask you was how difficult it is to adapt to the sensibilities of the time. You've drawn for three very distinct eras of superhero comics, so he's curious as how you've managed to evolve your style to meet each one of your runs on Spider-Man in particular.
You know, I just draw. I don't aim at any kind of particular style or anything like that. My style is always sort of evolving because I'm always trying to learn what I'm doing and try to get better at it. I do look at what's going on around me and what seems to be popular, and but I really don't worry about that sort of thing. I just try and do the best job I can the way I'm drawing at the time.
The next question was from Carlos, who wanted to know what it's like for you to work with Dan Slott, both on the Just Spider-Man and also Superior Spider-Man. And also, he wants to know how long you plan to do that for, which is probably as long as you can, right?
It's great working with Dan. We talked about working together for years. He's just so much fun to work with. He's like Brian. He's very enthusiastic. He's very positive. The other thing with Dan is you can't call him because you can't get him off the fucking phone. It's like, Dan, I gotta get back to work. And Superior, you know, the ultimate adjective of Spider-Man, now we're doing Superior. It's not going to be totally ongoing. I'm not going to say when it's going to end because I'm not exactly sure. But I'm enjoying it, and we're doing some really good storytelling. So enjoy it while it lasts, and we'll see what happens after that.
What is it like for you to be using characters like, you know, the Superior Spider-Man iteration, or using Spider-Boy, for example, who's obviously a new character that you helped create? Like, what is it like working on these much more newer spider-related characters?
Well, that's an interesting question, because, you know, I don't read that many comics anymore. I know kind of what's going on, because I try and stay aware of, you know, what the characters, you know, where they are and that sort of thing, but it's hard to keep track. And I didn't read much of the Superior stuff. I didn't read much of the, you know, Spider-Verse stuff. So I've had to go back and kind of get educated on what the hell I'm drawing. But, you know, the point is, you know, the most important thing is I'm enjoying what Dan's writing, and visually I'm enjoying drawing it. So, you know, Spider-Boy is, you know, that I know about because basically that's... No, I drew him the first published. I didn't design him, but Humberto Ramos, I love saying his name, Humberto Ramos designed him. But, you know, he's an interesting character, and it's fun to see where that's going to go. At this point in my career, it's, as long as the story's good and the characters are interesting, it's just fun to draw.
Next question comes from Aaron, who wanted to know if outside of comics, there are artists or styles that you see as influences on your work.
Outside of comics?
Mm-hmm.
Al Williamson, Frank Frazetta. I've been actually, on my off time, I've been trying to draw some Conan illustrations because I loved Conan when I was a kid, and I still do, and I tried drawing, you know, like illustrating his stories when I was, you know, in high school or whatever, and I couldn't because they were terrible. I'm just trying to, like, an illustration or two from each story of his, and just on the up, and I'm trying to semi-retire, which they won't let me do. But outside of that, I right now I can't come up with anything off the top of my head.
That's okay. Next question, and I promise we're almost done these.
That's how it is.
Pardon me?
I said, I know it's okay because I'm not asking for your permission. I'm just telling you how it is.
perfectly fair. What would you, this question comes from Cody, wanted to know, what would you say sets your current rendition of Spider-Man apart from your past work with the character? Because obviously, as we've said before, you did Ultimate Spider-Man, you did the amazing run in the 90s. What kind of sets apart your current take on the character?
It's weird. I'm trying to get more and more refined with my drawing, more and more settled into it, less cartoony, but I realize that the less cartoony I get, the more cartoony I want to be, because Spider-Man, you know, is this character. I mean, I look at Alex, who's Flash Gordon, Alex Raymond. I mean, he started out, he was so rough, and he got so refined, you know? I don't know if I want to be that refined or if I can get that refined, but I'm trying to get a little bit more like that. You know, I mean, JR is, you know, John Romita Jr. is, I think he's trying to get less refined and more kind of abstract in the way he draws, and it's great. I mean, the way it works for him, and he's a much better artist than I'll ever be in a lot of ways. But I'm trying to go in a different direction than that, and I'm not one of these guys who kind of like intellectually determines how I want to draw. You know, there are a few guys who can do that. I just draw and just go at it and see how it develops. And you know, it's my, if I go 6 months or a year without like drawing a lot of scientific equipment, I have to go back and look at how I drew scientific equipment to go, oh yeah, that's how that works, and this is how I can do it now, because I don't retain a lot of that stuff. I've got to refresh myself, which may be a good thing, because I think if you remember exactly how you did it before, then you just do it the same way, and that can lead into, like, you know, dead end alleys. But that just may be me and my imagination.
Another question, this one's from Joel. They were curious what it was like working with Pat Gleason when you did an issue of the Spider-Man Beyond era, because he thought it was super interesting to wonder what it would be like to work with someone who wrote a comic who's actually an artist themselves, and if that script or plot felt different or kind of read different than by someone who's not primarily an artist.
It's always better working with a writer who has some artistic ability, because they kind of visualize better and they can do some visual storytelling. Mm-hmm. Pat is so damn good. It's crazy. And there's this one panel where he's calling for Spider-Man to be dragged behind the Goblin Queen or the Queen Goblin or whatever, whichever one was in his arc. And he had this scene where she like turns and he's dragged behind her by the spider web and grabs something and whips her around, whatever. And I could not visualize it to save my life. I mean, I couldn't work it out in my head how that was going to work. And I'd never done this before. I called and said, can you give me some idea what you're looking for here? And, you know, he sent me back a sketch of, oh yeah, this is sort of kind of how the panel should look like. I'm like, okay, that works, you know. So like I said, it's always great working with a writer who, you know, has an idea what the hell they're doing visually. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you know, what he does is way different than what I do, and you know, good God, he's dynamic as hell. But he knows what he's doing when it comes to visual storytelling and the shorthand that goes with that.
For sure. Well, again, Mark, thank you so much for your time. You've been tremendously gracious, and I really appreciate your time. If you're willing to come back at some point to talk about everything you've worked on since like 2001 to now, we'd absolutely love to have you back. This has been really a thrill for me. I used to joke that if I ever got a chance to speak to you, I wouldn't even need to do a podcast anymore, because you were like the one guest I really wanted to talk to.
Your white whale.
You were my white whale. So thank you very much. I'm not actually ending the podcast, because I just got started doing it again, but metaphorically, like this was the moment. So I really appreciate you coming on and being so gracious with your time to talk about your career.
All right, well, let's do this again sometime relatively soon, because I wouldn't mind finishing it. It's fun doing something like this. I don't do it very often, so all right.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And I'll make sure that we do this again before too long.
All right. Take care.
Take care.